You're listening to the Partisan Comms Podcast.
There is a signal broadcast every second of every day through our television sets.
All right, welcome to episode 4. I'm Terrence, and today I'm joined by YouTube content creator AppSynthesis, also known by his other YouTube channel, Basic American Preparedness. And App, I really appreciate you taking the time to do an episode with me.
Absolutely, happy to do it.
And for those not familiar with your content, can you describe a little bit about both of your channels, Basic American Preparedness and AppSynthesis, and I guess what the theme is for each one?
Sure. So it's a little bit of a garbled tale, actually. So with my main channel, AppSynthesis, we started it a number of years ago, just as basically a multimedia project, just to mess with some of my audio visual gear, if you will. And around that time, I started kind of, I guess, becoming more of aware of my need to prepare for the future. So I kind of took on my hobbies and interests at that time, which became kind of, I guess, almost a superficial level of preparedness, if you will.
Right.
And so we changed the name of the channel. It started as American Sound Lab, right?
Mm-hmm.
It changed to American Survival Lab. And what I found through time, and this is probably some good advice for anybody that's looking into getting into creating content, that if you really want to grow content in YouTube, you really have to have a consistent brand. And I haven't done a good job of doing that. So I got really into synthesizers there for a while. And to make a long story short, the name got changed again to Synth Gunner there for a while because I started collecting guns and doing gun content exclusive. So yeah, and it was kind of crazy there for a while because I was actually buying like a gun a month. And actually... buying it with my own money, and I guess it was kind of times were good. And so anyway, to make a long story short, I kind of came to a point where I found that that wasn't sustainable, and I didn't really, you know, with the changing times and the political winds kind of constantly shifting, I was like, well, maybe I just don't want to have a lot of constant gun content out there. So we made yet another name change to AppSynthesis. It's kind of a play on multiple concepts. Now I do or have worked as a chemist, so there's been some synthesis in my actual professional career, and then playing synthesizers, music, there's that aspect, and then just the I guess the taking of multiple ideas and synthesizing them into one cohesive idea is kind of what the theme of the channel has become.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really become like a catch-all. And I guess at some point I was just doing gear mostly on this channel, and I wanted to switch up a little bit and talk about political things, philosophical things, kind of more serious, heady topics. So I actually started another channel just to do that, and it was called Post-American Preparedness. And so the theme was, it was a black pill theme, basically. That was the whole concept, because we kind of went from a transition from, you know, kind of blue pill normie mindset to kind of a red pill. That's a whole story all in itself, but then to more of a black pill thing. And I guess you know, my philosophy and personal mindsets ever shifting has been, I mean, I'm in my mid-40s. I can't point to a time in my life where I've been the same, I guess, or throughout a consistent period of time, if you will, if that makes sense.
So yeah, I can relate to that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should, you know, be eternal students and always be prepared to change based off new information coming in. But so now both the channels are kind of a function of that. I really haven't been posting on Post-American Preparedness, which I changed to Basic American Preparedness with the idea that it would maybe be, I don't know, more accessible to a general audience. And I just didn't really want to be a Debbie Downer all the time, if you will. And And so... that's basically the gist of it, and that was a little long-winded, but that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I kind of got a sense that I guess you have quite an eclectic group of topics. I think I watched almost all of your videos on both channels just to kind of prep for this and get a sense of, I guess, kind of what you're after in terms of an audience and the kind of message that you're trying to convey. And I, you know, picked up that, you know, you're a scientist by trade, and I believe you're also an Air Force veteran. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Four plus years.
And you brought up, you know, several times in a few videos about, you know, working as a, you know, heavy equipment mechanic, and I guess that was your primary job in the Air Force.
Correct. Yep. I did that for 4 years in the Air Force, and then a little over 2 years professionally once I was discharged. And it definitely was a really great skill set to add overall. But to kind of get back to the eclectic thing, I think that's kind of it's both a blessing and a curse, right? Because mm-hmm. you can't really, if let's just say you wanted a consistent audience, being eclectic is not the formula for a consistent product, if you will. And I think I've come to realize that it's kind of, I like to put things in terms of music. And I think of somebody like Maynard James Keenan, the singer for Tool.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in Tool. He was in a couple other bands, Green Jelly, if you will. And then some time went on, and then he went on to form a Perfect Circle, and then he formed Pussifer, and he's in like three or four bands. And if you listen to him, like in interviews, like he goes on Joe Rogan and stuff like that, he'll basically say that one band is not enough for him. One musical style is not enough for him. And I'm kind of that way with genres, because I've just crossed so many, I guess, mm-hmm. being such a hobbyist that I can't keep a consistent topic or a consistent product. And it can be a blessing and a curse. I could make probably a channel just off my, you know, my exploration into photography, if you will. You know?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, trying to be, you know, a Renaissance man, if you will. I think a good indicator of a well-rounded person is one who's able to discuss a range of topics. And, you know, I guess that's kind of one of the things that really interested me about your content is you do often dive into a variety of subjects. And I will attempt to try and touch on several of them that you've covered in previous videos. So forgive me if it seems like I'm jumping around on topics a little bit, but
no worries.
One of the ones that I thought was interesting is a reoccurring talking point on, you know, basically how one spends their time and really the importance of not wasting it, because time on this earth is of course finite. And in a few of your episodes, you seem to devote time towards prepping. And I guess one of my first questions is, you know, was there like a particular event or a situation in your life that occurred which caused you to place an importance on prepping?
That's a really great question, because I think the answer is both yes and no. It was kind of a combination of that cycle of going from kind of just accepting the narrative as it's received, as it's inputted, versus having kind of that red pill to black pill kind of transition. That was part of it. And a lot of that had to do with my cognitive dissonance associated with the philosophy that I thought I had in my head versus the reality that I was observing, you know, on a empirically on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started to notice probably in my mid-30s that a lot of adult people actually were not capable of listening to reason. And I experienced this in law, in the family court system, actually, where, you know, I just assumed that by explaining a situation and being morally right, or correct, if you will, that, you know, the situation would end in your favor. And of course, with the, you know, broken court system and the divorce and the family law system I went through, kind of losing everything, it was obviously a consciousness-raising event, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Then, I guess, you know, becoming older and a taxpayer and starting to own things caused a lot of, I guess, political and philosophical shifts in my 30s. And then, I think it was around 2014 or 2015 when I really started kind of paying attention more to geopolitical events. And it was around the time when Russia actually annexed Ukraine. And it was just a combination of all that cognitive dissonance and observing reality and not adding up to the narrative on top of geopolitical events that were seeming kind of serious. It was almost like everything kind of snapped at once in 2016. And I just felt a tremendous sense of urgency, like the timeline was speeding up, if you will.
Was this also while you were in the Air Force? Were these things thinking about? Or
No, I had been out 13 years. I mean, I've always been kind of cosmologically minded, if you will. I've always thought, I thought bigger and deeper about things. It was kind of an extension of being in the Air Force, and I can't remember where I was. I think it was at Vandenberg or something like that. And I stumbled upon a book about the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo space programs in the base library, and actually was signed by, I think it was Buzz Aldrin.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah. It got me really interested in space. And there's obviously, an extension of the air power thing, the flight thing that extends into the space thing. Obviously, all those guys and those early NASA programs were pilots, Navy pilots, Air Force pilots. So, it got me interested in space, which got me interested in science. And I guess I started interested in astronomy, which was what I started in college as. So really using my GI Bill, that kind of transition from, finding that book in the library, getting interested in space from a flight standpoint, and then a lot that informing my college career. I did eventually switch from, astronomy to chemistry and biology, which was a very smart move.
Obviously, it seemed to have worked out for you.
Yeah, and informed my career. But I guess that's kind of a long-winded way of saying it was really just a long progression of multiple consciousness raising events that got me to the point where I'm like, this is a dangerous world. The narrative that's, inserted in that's thrusted towards us, that's shoved down our throats on a daily basis, is just that, just a narrative. And it's not getting any safer or more sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
From a societal standpoint. So
you mentioned a kind of a feeling of a sense of urgency. So I mean, at some point, was there like a specific scenario that you decided you were going to start prepping for, or is it really just kind of a culmination of really just kind of all the things that you just mentioned?
It was a culmination of all the things that I just mentioned, but then I also went through a cycle, right? I went through the commercial cycle, if you will. Oh my gosh. I have to start preparing. I know nothing. I have nothing. And so you start the things that are immediately accessible to you when you decide, when you make that conscious decision that you need to become more prepared,
mm-hmm.
especially if you didn't grow up with it. Like, let's just say you're just like some Norman being like, oh my God, I don't know anything. I got to start preparing. The thing that's immediately available to you is the commercial crap, right? The stuff where people are out to make money.
Gotta max out that credit card so you can buy the next bug out bag, I guess.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. All the, 5-in-1 survival tools, the pre-made bug out bags, the programs that from the prepper channels, you could go on and on because I don't have anything against people making money.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. But, there's smart people that want to make money know that when there's a need or a societal shift or a trend, that there's money to be made, and prepping is no exception to that. And especially, since 2020, with the pandemic, it's kind of, you saw many cycles of it, raising and going in and out of zeitgeist, if you will, over time, if that makes sense.
From what I kind of gather from some of your videos, you do seem like you're a person that's got quite a bit going on. You seem like you've got a lot of irons in the fire, a lot of projects, things like that. I guess with prepping, how do you balance that lifestyle with work, family, social life, and then, of course, all your other projects?
Well, For one, there is no social life. That's one.
Yeah, but that goes away when you get older, I hear.
Yeah, well,
I'm 40. Well, I'm almost 44. So, you know, I definitely relate.
Yeah, no, 100%. I've always been an introvert. So the social life thing was never a thing for me to begin with. But I guess at this stage, it's there really isn't a lot of balance. I wish I could say that there was, but it's really just as long as I can find time to spend time with my family and loved ones and remain healthy, the philosophy is to burn the candle at both ends. While information, training, skills, and items are available. And I think probably the philosophy that I take as far as all the irons in the fire, if you will, is to try to consistently stay with the basics and try to find a couple of different systems to focus on and then focus on them through reps and sets. And I think what I've chosen to do that is one, martial arts, one, training, right? Because really the goal in all that is to eventually to impart all of this stuff to my children.
Yeah, you recently got into, I believe, Aikido, right?
Hapkido, yep. Okay. Combat Hapkido.
Very cool.
Yeah, Kali. It's the it's got so many names because it's got such a long, diverse history, but the Filipino martial arts, basically. Either call it Kali, Modern Arnis, or Modern Eskrima, but it's stick fighting. And the sticks are analogs to blades, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, we're moving towards reps and sets in what I would refer to as sustainable systems, or systems that have stood the test of time. So basic training in hand fighting, combat, martial arts, and then beyond that, things like homesteading, teaching. I mean, we're learning ourselves things like chickens, raising chickens, gardening, trying to learn how animals and plants interact with the soil and cycling things out. I mean, very basics. I think that's where we're at right now. And that's why you see a very, I guess, toned down approach to how the content I make. I'm intentionally not making clickbaity content, intentionally making toned down, very subtle, back to basics content.
And it's probably hard to compete with, you know, other content creators that do throw out that clickbait, you know, thumbnails and titles. And, you know, I could see where, you know, it could be difficult to actually get something like substantive out there and actually have people watch.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, for me personally, and this is just me, you have to make a conscious decision on whether you actually want to be a YouTuber or not. And that might sound really simple and basic on its face, but I think there's people, there's folks out there, there's different types of content creators and YouTubers. There's definitely the majority of people want to get as many subscribers as possible and views as possible. Otherwise, why else would you do it? I think folks that are more kind of on our spectrum, and I'm speaking more for me than you, obviously, is that at this point, if I put some content out there that is very niche, but is very specific, and a couple people latch onto it and are interested in it, then it's worth taking a look to do it.
That's kind of what interests me as well. A minute ago, you mentioned being an introvert, which is kind of funny because I consider myself one as well. And I know that's probably kind of antithetical to like to think that someone that's an introvert would have a YouTube channel. And I enjoy kind of the same things. I like all the kind of eclectic different tastes and subjects. And, you know, some of the content that I throw out is like really dry radio content, but I have a lot of other interests as well. And it's hard to, you know, like you're saying, when you went through a little bit of a rebranding. You know, you've got all these things that are kind of like, you know, culminating and all these really neat things that you want to throw out there to people, and it doesn't always translate as well as you'd like. But if you can get one or two people that are like really interested, I think it's worth it, you know, because I mean, yeah, you can devote your channel to trying to, you know, get as many subs as you want. But really, at the end of the day, unless people are engaged with you, it's not very fun.
Yeah, that's true. And I think on top of that, too, just to kind of augment that, it's hard for me to be fake, right? And I think part of the reason why I was kind of disgusted with myself and rebranded a few times and kind of broke my channel is because I saw the pull of trying to talk a certain way, try to edit a certain way, just to get people to put eyeballs on my content to increase that number. And it just didn't feel right, you know? And well, you'll never get the audience that other people get, but if you get to a place where you could accept that, then like you said, you know, it's worth it. And then also, why do you do it, right? I mean, me, I enjoy the act of creation. And the thing about making a video is it's an audio video experience, and creating that, just the act of doing it, I enjoy sometimes. Like, for example, I put out I've had this Ranger Grip 79 Swiss Army knife for 2 years, and I wanted to do a video about it for at least a year. And I was like, no, I'm going to wait and make sure I've used it a number of times and it doesn't break. I can say it's a decent knife. And I finally did a video on it today, and I put it out maybe 3 hours ago. It took me maybe an hour's worth of effort to actually make it between filming the content, editing it, and then waiting for it to upload and making the avatar. And maybe 50 people will watch it. And that some people out there are probably like, well, why even do that when people are out there and, you know, getting 500,000 views, 5 million views. And it's like, well, I enjoyed the act of sitting there for the hour and actually creating it.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that. There have been a few times where I'm like, well, maybe I'll do a video about, you know, this thing. And I usually end up kind of putting it off because either I haven't tested it or, you know, played with it myself, you know, enough, or maybe it just wasn't the right time. And there are other times where, I mean, with a lot of the amateur radio stuff, I'm not really covering any new ground anyway. I mean, there's really nothing out there that hasn't already been done. So, you know, that kind of makes it difficult as well. And I can see where, you know, doing a product review for prepping could be a little bit difficult because you are competing again with a lot of clickbaity type stuff. But a question that I hear that comes up kind of often, I guess among a lot of, you know, people that consider themselves preppers, is kind of regarding personal relationships and basically, you know, is their spouse on board with the prepping lifestyle and to what extent? I guess my question for you is, what is your experience with that?
My experience has been pretty good, but I don't know if my experience is the exception or the norm. I have an amazingly supportive wife who tends to go along with whatever harebrained schemes or shenanigans I happen to get into. And that's part of the reason why we make it work. I mean, there's been other harebrained schemes in the past that weren't as productive as prepping. I can tell you that much, right?
Have you ever had to deal with any like cynicism from non-preppers or ridicule or anything of that nature?
I think, no, I think really more due to the nature of me being an introvert and only interacting with my family and work, that's probably just the limited number of people that I'm around. I don't really get a lot of backlash on that, but, you know, going back to the constantly changing thing, you know, it's like spiritually I've changed a lot. And my relationship with God has changed a lot. And that's caused some schisms recently. And I'm not going to go too deep into that. But it's almost a function of the preparedness thing, though, because it's all related.
Well, you do have, and I guess I would describe it as some light theological commentary regarding the importance of preparedness. I know that there's probably a danger in getting too deep because, you know, some people might lose interest or, you know, you'll
sure
ignite a conversation that you may not intend. But
right.
A question that I've been wondering for a little while after watching your videos is, are there any specific examples or lessons that you've read which have kind of resonated with you and have reinforced your attitude towards prepping? Because I know that, you know, there are a couple of videos where you brought up several books. Scriptures is one of them, of course, and, you know, several others. And I was kind of wondering if there's anything in there that really just kind of jumped out at you and made you say to yourself, I'm kind of confirming, you know, what I already thought by reading this.
Yeah, really almost everything I read in there at this point is kind of reinforcing on universal themes. And it's kind of hard to unpack that and explain it without the reps and sets of both coming from the context of, I guess, 7 years of preparation, and then the journey of finding faith at the same time. And then realizing when you go back and you read that book and all throughout it, which there's hundreds to thousands, arguably, of years in between some of those stories, of how there's themes in that book that they reoccur and they layer upon themselves and they repeat to repeat a theme that is a kind of a high level concept that preparation embodies. Now, I'll give you an example. So I didn't really want to bring this up too much, but you know, I'm a student of another YouTuber, Saws, right? And so it's Survival Application Weapon System. And he has a Patreon. And I happen to be like the highest level tier there. So I get all of his content. I also went out and trained with him personally. And when you spend a lot of time with a particular teacher in a particular school, obviously you take on that school of thought, right? And he teaches a lot from a very biblical mindset. And what I found through the reinforcement, the reps and sets, if you will, of reoccurring themes through his instruction, being a former Green Beret and Ranger and things, he always draws upon concepts from that book. And the concepts in that book, they layer upon themselves just like his training. I actually think that he uses the Bible as a template for how he teaches without actually saying so. It's kind of interesting. But if you go back and you look at the stories, any of the stories, whether it be Exodus or any of the first, you know, five books, the Torah, even into the extension through the Tanakh, there's a lot of reoccurring themes of preparedness, martial preparation for war, preparation for times of famine, times of want, times of need. And really, that's really informed a lot of, I guess, my mindset regarding preparation over the last year or so. And that's why it's gone so far away from, I guess, the clickbaity and the superficial concepts and back to basics, going back to the beginning. You know, starting with sticks, digging in the dirt. I mean, he even brings up, and if you go back and read, and like Deuteronomy, the basics of carrying something as simple as a stick or a shovel, you know, to bury your excrement. That's a very basic preparedness story that a lot of people would probably miss out on by not thinking about going back to the beginning. So that got really long-winded and tangential, so I don't
know. No, it made sense because while you were, you know, mentioning that, I was kind of thinking about just some of the preparation that I've made for, you know, this episode. And I went back and actually looked through, you know, several parables and stuff like that, just to kind of figure out if there's kind of a deeper prepper meaning in the Bible, if you will. And there is, you're absolutely right. There's, if you really look, there's actually quite a bit in there that you could really just, I guess you could interpret it really as, you know, stories about prepping, like, you know, the parable of the 10 virgins, I think that's in Matthew. And that's one that comes to mind that I kind of focused on when I was just kind of looking through all of them. And it really is kind of interesting when you look at it through that lens. And I don't hear a lot of people talk about that. Maybe just a handful yourself, and I've heard of a couple of others. But whether you believe in all the miracles or not, whether you have, you know, faith or not, you know, there is some interesting lessons to be learned, I think. And I wish that, I don't know, I guess I wish there was, you know, some more content out there like that, because I think it is interesting and substantive. And, you know, it is a deviation from, you know, the unboxing videos and things like that.
Yeah, and that's just the thing, the deeper stuff, you know, the stuff where people are searching for meaning to inform things like their preparedness or even their lifestyle for their family. It doesn't sell, you know, like the really the shiny stuff, right?
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, when you watch a lot of these channels, I always wonder where they kind of derive their thought process from. That's kind of one of the first questions I usually have is, you know, why are you so focused on this? Why are you so interested? Why do you have that kind of, I don't know, sense of urgency with a lot of these people? And I don't know that you necessarily get that with a lot of these channels, because they don't, some of them just don't go in depth like that. And that's okay. You know, like you said earlier, it really depends on what your aim is, you know, as a content creator. Are you trying to get subs? Are you trying to turn it into a business? And, you know, likewise, I feel the same way. I'm not going to knock anyone for trying to make a buck, but I'm just kind of a naturally curious person in general. And so, that's what I liked about your content, basically, because I'm like, you know, this guy talks about a lot of different stuff. Technology is certainly one of them. You had I think it's either two or three videos, but they were titled Grid Down EMP or Cyber Attack. And I had just gotten done reading this book 1 second after. I don't know if you've read it, but basically it's about, you know, an EMP in the United States. And in your video, you talked about how we're living in potentially, you know, one of the most dangerous periods in human history, and that the geopolitical situation does seem dire, and we could be on the precipice of a major conflict. And I think that video, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it might have been approximately a year or so ago that you did it, and you discussed the possibility of EMPs and cyber attacks. Do you still believe the probability of either of those two scenarios is likely?
That's an interesting question, because when I made that particular content, I was much more concerned about those types of things. I think it, whether I'm able to predict the likelihood of those events, I really can't say. But I think my concern about them is much less now. And that really doesn't have to do with a more advanced level of preparedness, although maybe it does, but from a different, I guess from a different angle of intersection, if you will. But I know when I made those, that content, those two videos, and I believe I split them in two, because I remember I spent the whole weekend making those two videos, and they were not big, big movers as far as, you know, eyes on video. But you know, I mean, the basics are that, you know, the human race has enjoyed this period of technological advance and the electronic era depending on how you really slice and dice history, for a very small percentage of time. And we've become acclimated and equilibrated to this first world, you know, electronic grid lifestyle. And, you know, it's pretty basic prepper 101 that we're so acclimated to this very soft lifestyle that were there an event to happen, you know, we'd be pretty, it'd be pretty rough, pretty quick, I think. And, I think it's Bill Forsten that wrote that book, One Second After, which
Bill Forsyth or something to that effect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they even referenced the congressional report or whatever that was written around the time that book was authored about the percentage of people that would pass away, whether to actually be a grid down event.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of weird because you could see some semblance of the grid rotting before our very eyes. I think that comes back to the sudden SHTF versus long, protracted, drawn out, painful, slow death SHTF. I think the grid is dying on that long, protracted ladder situation that I just mentioned already.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. You know, if you, besides the book One Second After, I think there was a book that I also referenced in those two videos called Lights Out by Ted Koppel, right?
So that one I haven't read. I saw it. It's on my reading list though.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty good. He goes into, the large, transformers, if you will, that, are totally outmoded, and it takes like two trucks to transfer one across state. And
right,
it would, like 14 months to replace one were it to be damaged or something like that. But I think at this point that, you know, the government has probably hardened itself the federal government, that is, to a certain point where they're going to assure continuity of government, whether to be a real, like, you know, let's just say Carrington event or EMP or something like that. And I think there's going to eventually become a point, and this is going to probably sound kind of weird to some people, but with the grid rotting the way it is, and with the way people are kind of, or the United States is constantly degenerating towards more of a third world status, I think there's going to be a point probably in the next 20, 25 years where it wouldn't even matter if it happens, because people are going to be used to kind of living in hybrid grid situations, if that makes any sense.
Well, you know, in the videos that you did, I thought you raised some really good points. You know, essentially you discussed, you know, how our hardware infrastructure is aging, but it's also paired with like state-of-the-art computerized software. I believe that's how you stated it. And, you know, really, you know, you went on to say that the ability to hack or gain access to systems has become more pervasive over the years. And in a way, having all of our infrastructure controlled by these systems is kind of ripe for a negative outcome. And, you know, I mean, with some of the events that have gone on the last, you know, few years, some of the, you know, suspicious issues with infrastructure, I mean, you can see, you know, that kind of coming into play. I don't think you were wrong about that. And I guess the question is really, you know, are there ways that, you know, we can balance, you know, really our dependence on technology and avoid some of the pitfalls that you mentioned in those videos, as well as some of these other sources that we've mentioned where they're kind of calling out the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find a balance, because I think what I mentioned in that video is, like, for example, the military and the federal government is taking some measures to put air gaps in place, right, to make sure that their systems are isolated to where that they're not able to be hacked, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, individuals could take that strategy as well. Another strategy too would be just to kind of move away from the tech. I know one mentor I have, he has a saying, there's no school like the old school, right? And though it might not be a sustainable system to rely on things like, for example, the U.S. Postal Service or snail mail or something like that. But to try to find a core set of technology that you can embrace that you know is going to be sustainable for your personal situation is the philosophy and approach I'm taking. Like, I'm not trying to get more technologically advanced in this stage in the game. I'm looking at ways that I can find ways to go analog or old school or use deedles. That's just my personal situation, but I also am a realist. I don't have a fat head to think I'm some big prepper where if, you know, the grid were to go down, I would have everything squared away too, right? So I'm looking at very low-tech situations, I guess, if you will. Low-tech, sustainable situations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. I was kind of looking around my office the other day, and I was looking at all this radio stuff I've got, and I'm like, I have way too much stuff. And if anything were to ever happen, I don't know that I could sustain most of it. And, you know, so I started getting into, like, solar stuff and figuring out how to charge my equipment, you know, through panels and charge controllers and lithium batteries and stuff. But, you know, I mean, if we ever had some sort of long-term scenario, like, is, you know, detailed in that that book, One Second After, we'd be in a lot of trouble, you know, long-term. But yeah, I understand what you're saying, because lately I've kind of been doing a similar thing where I'm like, you know, I'm not looking to get more advanced than I already am as far as technology is concerned. I think I'm probably right where I need to be. And, you know, I think I'm ready to maybe point my arrow in another direction and focus on other stuff. But I guess another topic that you you discussed, and I believe you brought it up on the Basic American Preparedness channel, and you're asking the audience, you know, basically where they derive their values from and what makes them an American. Because, you know, I guess if, you know, there was this like ultimate SHTF event, you know, you'd find out pretty quick, you know, where people stand as far as values are concerned. And I think I have kind of an idea of where you stand, but, you know, where would you say that you are in the value spectrum? And how did you arrive at your belief system?
That's a great question. Interestingly timed as well, considering, you know, that discussion we had earlier about how, you know, things are always in a dynamic state of change. You know, coming from a place just, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years ago where I was always trying to find a secular humanist approach to value system, right? If you go out and you look at, like, right now, the United Nations has their basic human rights doctrine or whatever. That would have been something that I would have pointed to maybe 5 to 10 years ago. But me personally, I've found those things to be somewhat wanting, especially since I've seen, you know, the progressives and the people attempting to be in charge that, you know, base their decision making based off those types of things. But for me right now, it really just comes down to, it's going to sound pretty basic and corny, but the Ten Commandments. And really, if you look at to how American society was formed, if you go back to the evolution of the, let's just say the Puritans, the folks that came over here from England and established the colonies and into the events that started the American War for Revolution. I mean, arguably, you know, those quote unquote Judeo-Christian values are kind of the bedrock of our society. And that's why it's interesting that right now, that's what I would say informs my personal morality. But the danger, the concern, if you will, is that there's a grand schism, right? There's really a bifurcation in the direction of philosophies in our society right now. And you have, well, it's ironic that I'm moving towards that value set, moving away from perceived notions of secular humanism into more of a Ten Commandments-based approach to where I derive my morality from. You have a large percentage of the population which is kind of throwing that away, moving away from that, embracing more of a pre-Judeo-Christian, if you will, or a pagan system, and that's going to cause a problem going forward. But how I govern my day-to-day is very basic. I try to, as I find my faith more and more and recognize that there is a creator, I try to, number one, express as much appreciation and try to do what that creator said in the instructions, which I've chosen to be my instructions, which is, you know, what they refer to as the Holy Bible. And then number two, try to apply that that same appreciation towards the creator that created me towards my fellow man. And that's really hard to do when so many of those fellow men are moving away from that basic set of instructions. But if you just keep those two core values in you, just to try to appreciate the creator and appreciate your fellow man as much as that, I find that your day-to-day interactions really are a lot easier. Just keeping that in mind as a basic default, basic calibration.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I find it's hard some days, especially when other people don't, when it's not reciprocal. Well, and it's in many cases not reciprocal, and you got to do what you got to do to guard yourself too. You got to, you know, be in a defensive state. You can't be a pushover. You can't misapply, you know, the whole turn the other cheek thing, because people misapply that.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, it does seem like there's a lot of different ideas and value systems, and everyone's kind of living their own reality in parallel. And you know, perhaps at some point, all those things will be on a collision course. And I don't know what the result of that is. I mean, if you look on social media, whether it's Twitter, or I guess it's X now, whatever you want to call it, and some of the others, you know, there's a lot of negativity about that. There's a lot of, you know, people saying that, you know, all of the things that we're witnessing right now with the government, with certain people in power, with certain people in our society, that we are in decline. Do you think that's true? Do you think we're kind of in a downward trend?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, there's a lot of evidence throughout history that civilizations rise and fall, that there's a cyclical nature to, you can point to the cycle of, you know, what is it, what they call the Gardner cycle. I can't remember the name of it, but, you know, strong men build civilization and weak men tear it down, basically, mm-hmm. to summarize it, if you will. And we're definitely in that weak men cycle. And I really do think, I personally believe it has to do with that lack of moral clarity. The move towards quote unquote what people are defining as progress right now has really kind of muddied the philosophical view of mankind in many ways. A lot of people, you know, it kind of comes back to the basic argument of asking yourself, yeah, you could, but should you, right? It's the beginning of every science fiction movie where things go wrong, right? The scientist does something because they could, as mm-hmm. opposed to whether they should. And I think the nature of current, I don't know, progressivism, if you would call it that, is a lot of people are saying, hey, people should be able to do what they want. They should be able to do what they could. And there's not a lot of asking whether they should. And some people would say that's the, you know, the basic good versus evil, you know, God of this world thing, do what you feel kind of approach. But, you know, it really does come back to, is there right and wrong? Some people really believe that there's really no objective truth. And I used to be one of those people. I'd say I'm pretty firmly no longer one of those people, but the more you have people that have that, that think that there's no objective truth, that truth is subjective, then you can basically have whatever. And then you're heading towards a collision course of two majorly mutually exclusive philosophies. And it's going to be interesting to see where this whole thing goes.
Do you think that the, I won't call it a decline, I'll just say it's a downward trend, but because I don't really know for sure, to be honest with you. I wish I could, you know, say one way or the other, and then maybe that might, you know, help inform my decisions a little bit better. But do you think it's irreversible, or do you think that, you know, once you're on the kind of like the downward slope, that, you know, you reach like an inevitable conclusion, and then there's just a, you know, something to fill that vacuum, I guess?
Yeah, I don't exactly know, but I can say that I don't, we're not in skyscraper building phase, right? We're not in early 20th century Atlas Shrugged, where everything's on the new and new,
right?
Everything's exciting. It feels very decline and rotten-ish, if you will. And I think the a very brief scan of the American cityscape and infrastructure would inform that, right? I mean,
Detroit used to be, you know, a, you know, kind of a booming city, and it's no longer that.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, there's, if you look at the basic contract that is American society, American government, if you will, like the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, all the arguments, the Federalist Papers, all the discussion that went on during that time. You know, a lot of that assumes a common morality, a common moral code, if you will. And when you no longer have that, then those binding principles become a lot harder to functionally continue to manifest for everyone, if you will. It's kind of like the way people are actually have an argument about the Second Amendment, actually have an argument about freedom of speech. Like, really? You have an argument that you don't want that? But that's where we're at.
Well, it certainly doesn't feel like we're a serious country at this point. I mean, I won't go into a lot of detail on this because it's graphic, but I don't know if you've heard about, you know, that that staffer for, I think it's Senator Ben Cardin. He's a senator from Maryland. And
it's all didn't click, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I guess that guy was fired from his position, you know, and since the revelation of the video, some have commented on social media that it's an example of how our government and our society is in decline. And there's been others who have said that, you know, it's not a big deal, it's a personal matter, you know, as well as criticism that, you know, what this person did kind of shows contempt for our government, and, you know, as well as that senator's constituents. And I don't know, do you think that type of behavior by either government officials or their staff is an indicator that, you know, perhaps our government or even our society, you know, that's a symptom of the decline?
So I really think that kind of comes back to that kind of bifurcation in philosophy. Let me put it this way. How do you define decline? Right. So one person might define a movement towards disorder or a decline by a lack of function, let's just say, for argument's sake, a lack of function. So you would have people, let's just say on the progressive side, that say, hey, you know, it's okay. This guy's just doing what he wants, right? Didn't hurt anybody. Nobody got hurt, right? The whole, I guess, moving towards progressive liberalism side of the whole libertarian thing, right? But then you have other people that would say, well, that behavior in general on multiple levels, at multiple levels of intersection, both that it occurred, the type of thing that occurred, all of those are a form of dysfunction. The more examples that you have of dysfunction, arguably, some would define as a decline, at least I would, right? So it kind of comes back to that where is your world philosophy? Do you think people should just be able to do whatever they want and do what thou art, if you will, that whole
right,
you know, God of this world type of stuff? Or do you think that there is a certain code of instructions that people should abide to by function, to be functional? And I think the people that are on the latter side of that philosophy would say, yeah, that is a clear indication of decline. Whereas the other people would say, yeah, it's just somebody doing something and maybe it was inappropriate for the arena. But it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, I don't know if I struggle with it or not. I think that, you know, in deciding if it is a symptom of decline or not, or if it's just something that happened. I think, you know, the idea of, you know, decline and, you know, trying to figure out what the symptoms and causes are pretty interesting. You know, I don't know if you've heard or read about, I guess it's the Universe 25 mouse experiments.
But, yeah, not familiar with that.
Well, I won't go into like great detail, but for those listening, I can do just kind of a brief summary because it kind of ties into what we're talking about. And essentially, these were a series of experiments conducted by a guy named John Calhoun, and he did these experiments in the 60s and 70s. And he also was an American scientist, and he studied animal behaviors. And I guess these experiments were intended to observe, you know, what the effects of overpopulation and crowding and social behaviors were of mice. And this guy created like I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I was like, oh no, I have heard of that. Now that you're unpacking it, go ahead.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. There's some, for those listening, like you can go look on YouTube, go look it up, and there's a bunch of videos on it. But, essentially what this guy did is he created a series of enclosed habitats, and these were called universes, and hence the Universe 25 title. And the mice were provided with unlimited food, water. They had nesting materials, but they had limited space. And I guess what he did is he introduced like four pairs of mice into each universe, and he observed their population growth and behavior over time. So fast forwarding, as a result of these experiments, he figured out that as the population density increased, the mice exhibited various abnormal behaviors. Aggression was one of them, violence, cannibalism, hypersexuality was one. I think some of them went through withdrawal, apathy, and some of them neglected their offspring, which was kind of interesting. And he noticed that some of the mice, he called these the beautiful ones, and they isolated themselves from the rest of the population, and they spent pretty much all their time grooming, eating, and sleeping. And they didn't engage in any kind of like social activities. And over time, I guess they kind of lost the ability to interact with other mice. And so he concluded that they had reached a state of what he described as behavioral sink. And basically, the mice couldn't cope with the stress and complexity of their environment. And he suggested that his experiments had implications for human society, you know, because he saw some parallels between, you know, those mice in the experiment and the urban population, and kind of warned that humans could face a similar fate. And eventually, you know, after the mouse society collapsed, he ended up culling the rest of the population. But I don't know, I thought it was kind of an interesting story, and I think an awful lot about it when, you know, I see things like, you know, that kind of pop up in the news, and, you know, you kind of wonder, like, you know, are we seeing, you know, some of these things from Universe 2025 play out in human society?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm going to have to look into that a little bit further. Especially interested in that small group of set apart mice that went and did their own thing. But without being, you know, intimately familiar with that particular study, I do know, just based off my own study in biology, that, you know, carrying capacity is definitely a thing for any ecosystem, right? There's only a certain number of organisms that any ecosystem can sustain or support. But I do find it very interesting that the example that you just pointed out, that there it led to kind of like confusion and mayhem and even like sexual deviancy, because that's definitely a thing that is going on right now. What I also find fascinating is that that particular study that you just referenced is just based off population and not necessarily based off, I guess, informational bombardment, because not only do we have the population boom that the current, at least first world human race is experiencing, but you have the information exponential boom too, where people are not only dealing with vast amounts of people in large cities that they haven't necessarily dealt with in the past, but the Internet of Things and the information racing towards them at any given point in time. The human beings and at no point in history have had that. So that's something that wouldn't be necessarily represented in you know, the 25 thing. So I just got me thinking.
Well, there, the mouse behavior was really interesting because he set up all these feeding troughs, and for whatever reason, you know, the mice decided that they were going to congregate to like one or two, and all of these other troughs were open, and they would compete to eat from, you know, a couple main ones and actually, you know, get in fights over it. And while I was just kind of researching some of this stuff, I stumbled upon this on accident, but I guess there's a lot of theories about the fall of the civilization of Easter Island. And they had a series of devastating events that actually killed almost the entire population. And some of those theories suggest that over time, their society fell into a downward spiral of warfare, cannibalism, and population decline. But there's also, I guess, people who argue that society was, you know, mostly people peaceful and booming at the time, you know, of Western contact. And basically, it only went into this like catastrophic decline after the introduction of Western diseases and, you know, slaving raids, essentially. But there was a article that was published, I think it was sometime in 95, for Discover Magazine by this guy named Jared Diamond. He wrote another book, which also on my reading list, but it's Guns, Germs, and Steel, I believe. And he pretty much kind of covers the history of, you know, civilization. But in this article that he wrote, he said he believed the people of Easter Island wiped out their forests. They drove their plants and animals to extinction. And, you know, pretty much as a result, that's why their complex society spiraled into chaos, you know, and cannibalism. And a question that he posed even back then was, are we about to follow their lead? And I don't know, do you think there are parallels with our society and, you know, really kind of any of the examples that, you know, we just discussed with like an Easter Island or, you know, Universe 25? Could you see something like that playing out with our modern society?
Oh yeah, 100%. And by the way, Guns, Germs, and Steel is something that I have not read, but is on my reading list. So I'm glad that you brought that up as a reminder, because there's actually somebody else that's recommended that before. But I think when you do have those examples, and I'm not going to say too much because I haven't read the stuff, so I'm not familiar with it, but whenever you have examples of, let's just say, a society or a system, a human-based system that's working, that breaks down, I think you're going to have probably reoccurring dynamics regarding breakdown of social order, social structure, and lack of resources. And when there's lack of resources and I guess a certain amount of people and only a certain amount of resources, you're going to have those breakdown dynamics of, you know, people behaving badly, if you will, various ways, you know, fighting, stealing, cannibalism, if you will. What I can't really predict or don't necessarily understand is, I guess, how things would play out in our current dynamic? Because you got a very interesting thing, particularly, I mean, just coming from the context of United States American people, right? Mm-hmm. I can't see any other people in the history of this planet that are like these people in this country. I mean, you could arguably go to almost any other place in the world and people, and I haven't done a lot of traveling over the last 10 years, but I'm assuming, you know, not much has changed, but you know, people are basically have a default setting where they're still kind of attached to, I guess, older ways, if you will, as opposed to Americans that really seem to be really detached. They're really in their rectangles, if you will, their phones, their TVs, their tablets, whatever it is. They're really consumed by media. And I know this is kind of a dynamic that's become more prevalent all over the world as more people have become kind of more like American, because we've exported our culture all throughout the world, you know, even in Asia, Russia, no matter where it is, we've exported our culture. But to see, to get back to your question, of what, let's just say that the civilizational breakdown dynamics or societal breakdown dynamics of a very controlled environment like an Easter Island or something like that, you're talking about more like primitive situations or primitive peoples. And people all over the world, as opposed to Americans, still have more of that old world kind of programming, and arguably, I'm saying, from my context. So how Americans are going to interact with any type of sustained or even sudden breakdown, I can't really predict, because we have so much going against us, quite frankly, because we're so detached from sustainable systems that have stood the test of time. So probably not painting a very positive picture here, but I really do probably have more concern with us here in the United States as far as a actual event, more than I probably would be if I was sitting, I don't know, South America or some island somewhere, or maybe even some parts of Europe, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, we've got a lot of luxury here, you know, even if it doesn't, you know, feel like it sometimes, but we really do. I mean, we're very lucky and we're very fortunate, you know, to live in this country. And, you know, sometimes when I'm kind of just scrolling through the headlines or, you know, YouTube or whatever it might be, you know, there's always, I think it's always interesting where people are trying to look to certain events or situations and say, see, this is, you know, what I'm talking about. This is an example of, you know, why I think the wheels are going to come off the wagon. And one day I was actually driving to the gym, and sometimes I'll listen to, you know, YouTube videos in the background in the car just to, you know, have something to listen to. And actually one of those was a video you did on apophenia. And I thought that was an interesting topic. And, you know, it kind of got me thinking. And for those listening, you know, just to unpack it really quick, basically it's the tendency to perceive, I guess, meaningful connections or patterns between unrelated or random things. I guess this is something humans do. It's just pattern recognition, and it's common. It's a common process. And, you know, I guess it helps us make sense of the world. And it's a way of kind of finding order in chaos. But it can also lead us, I guess, to some false or irrational conclusions, which you pointed that out in your video, especially when we're influenced by emotions, bias, or expectations. And it got me wondering, you know, what you thought kind of about the YouTube prepping world. Like, do you think apophenia plays a role in that, you know, with some of these other content creators, some of the other content that you see?
Well, yeah, the short answer is yes. I mean, that's the most basic visceral gut reaction I can give you is absolutely yes. But, you know, secondly, I think, you know, apophenia, and it's kind of interesting that that particular, I'm glad you brought up that video, because that's a very interesting video that I've always wanted to go back and kind of talk about a little bit more, but couldn't really bring myself to do so because one, back when I was doing the post-American preparedness thing, I was in a very, I don't know, kind of weird mental state and was putting a lot of effort into like riddles and people trying to think deeper. And I put a lot of riddles into that video that nobody actually ever solved. But and another interesting thing about that particular video is about approximately 1 year later, a couple of other people, including Paul Harrell, did videos about the topic of apophenia. But getting back to your
question. Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah. It was like him and actually some other people that I follow as mentors were talking about it a year after. It was kind of some weird synchronicity going on there. And those people weren't even probably aware that I did that video a year before. But getting back to your question, I think there's a, to answer your question about apophenia and forming some of these things that are happening in the YouTube prepper sphere, I think if you separate the categories of the YouTube prepper sphere and contrast that coming from a context of, let's just say, conspiracy theorism, right? Because the YouTube prepper sphere kind of intersects with some of the pre-YouTube conspiracy theory kind of mindset world, if you will. Absolutely, apophenia, because you got to understand that the mere phrase conspiracy theory automatically in a certain segment of the population triggers a negative connotation or a connotation of incorrect or crackpottery. Right. Where the simple phrase conspiracy theory just implies somebody is posing a theory, right, that a conspiracy has occurred, you know, and a plan or amongst multiple people to conspire to perform an act or event. So absolutely, you have all these intersections of crackpottery, conspiracy theory, where you have a gradient, a spectrum, if you will, of conspiracies that range from are true, correct, factual, actually happened, to maybe a version of events that actually happened that maybe have been skewed towards crackpottery or maybe sensationalism towards batshit crazy, right? So you have a gradient, you have a spectrum in there.
Right.
So the ability for apophenia to manifest in the human mind spans that spectrum. So you have all flavors, all colors, all of the above of that spectrum from, yeah, that probably was a conspiracy. Those people conspired to do that crazy thing to, man, that's batshit crazy. You have all of that right at your fingertips, right in front of your eyes on YouTube. So it can become an exercise in very, I guess, a discernment, if you will, to kind of navigate through all that to figure out what is actually something that you want to feed through your interpretation of reality and manifest as something that, you know, you want to guide as far as making decisions going forward, if that makes sense. You have all matter, you have all flavors of the rainbow out there with crackpottery and the apophenia.
Well, and I mean, it's all really starts out as pattern recognition, right? I mean, honestly, until I heard your video, I hadn't really thought that it, you know, that had another term. And, you know, it's really kind of unfortunate that, you know, pattern recognition, which is just a basic thing that our brains do, you know, has kind of evolved into, you know, this term of misinformation in the news. You know, this, we're trying to protect against misinformation and conspiracy theories, and you know, it's all turned into kind of a pejorative, if you will. And it's unfortunate because there are some conspiracies that were real. You know, one of them would be, you know, John Wilkes Booth. He did, in fact, conspire to, you know, kill President Abraham Lincoln. He conspired with several people. They, you know, uncovered this conspiracy and figured it out. And so, I mean, you know, that's an example of a real one. But you know, like you said, you've got all flavors of the rainbow. You've got, you know, I guess when you're able to see shapes and clouds, you know, your mind is probably capable of, you know, a hell of a lot more, right?
Yeah, that, you know, you're absolutely 100% on target. That was kind of a more succinct way of saying what I was trying to say, that you can have some sensational things occur that are a true manifestation of reality, but then you can have a bunch of stuff just kind of add up to a picture that seems like reality, but it's not. It's kind of like, I can believe Jesus Christ came to earth and is our Lord and Messiah, and that be truth. But I can also say that that woman that saw Jesus's face in the tortilla on the taco is probably just experiencing pattern recognition.
Right.
Right. So you have, and then you have all the spectrum and gradients in between.
When I was a kid, I would, one of my favorite things to do would be, you know, I'd lay on the floor and like the dog would sit next to me and I'd look up at the popcorn ceiling and try and figure out if I could see shapes. I know it's kind of weird. I was a weird kid, but you're right. Like, you know, sometimes people see, you know, Jesus in the toast, or, you know, they see, you know, all kinds of, you know, other things, Elvis in a, you know, washcloth or something.
Right.
But I mean, it's, our brains obviously do it for a reason. You know, over time we've been, you know, we kind of evolved into, having this ability, and it's a powerful one because, you know, like you said in your video, I mean, the human mind is amazing. It can create symphonies and do science and math and create art and all these really amazing, beautiful things. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of unfortunate that people don't, you know, appreciate some of those simpler things that we're capable of. But kind of back to, I guess my first question is, you know, using your powers of apophenia, are there any, you know, connections that you see in current events or trends that, you know, concern you or that you think about?
Just the general grand trend towards people build up unsustainable societies and build systems that are imperfect, and a certain small percentage of people will continue to understand that those systems that man build are imperfect, and they have to reject that and seek more timeless universal systems. And, you know, that's really the only reoccurring theme I really see in the human condition, is that, you know, mankind has fallen and man keeps on trying to think he's going to do his own thing when really he should just do what he's supposed to do and follow the instructions. And it doesn't matter if you look at a current sampling, just go out and take a current cut of the reality that's in front of you and look at it, or go back to say 5,000 years ago and look at that. Depending on your context, you're going to see the same thing. You're going to see the same pattern. And maybe that's the apophenia I have, is that I see that same pattern occurring throughout the history books, throughout my experience interacting with, you know, being alive for 44 years.
How do you, how do you reconcile this stuff? Like, how do you kind of keep yourself in check, like in distinguishing between, I don't know, seeing a dog in the clouds, you know, just kind of standard apophenia, if you will, and then genuine patterns or, I guess, correlations in data or information?
It's hard to discern, because when you have reps and sets of discerning data, I mean, because I do that as a career, right? So I can go back to a time where I would look at, like corn gluten feed being dried to a certain percentage over the course of a 12-hour shift nightly, and I'm parsing this data over 12 months to say, oh, okay, that that dryer house and that corn plant is going bad, right? If you take that same observational approach and apply it towards your life, you end up with kind of, I guess, what meta statements, meta philosophies, if you will. It's like, okay, I've done this 10,000 times in this certain way, and this seems to work, or this doesn't work. And if you apply that same logic to how you form your daily philosophy, the thoughts, the philosophies that inform your daily life, then you add up what works and what doesn't, and you discard what works. It's kind of like you chew the meat and spit out the bones, but you retain that meat and it becomes protein that feeds your muscles. But you discarded the meat, or excuse me, the bones, right? And I take that as far as information on a daily basis.
Are there any kind of, I guess, how does that play out, like in a lab setting, for instance? You know, are there, you know, do you guys look at the same data and then arrive at drastically different conclusions and that creates conflicts, or, you know, what happens there?
Oh, yeah, 100%, especially if the data supports a conclusion that supports going in a direction towards a product or something that your executives don't like, for example. but no, yeah, that, you know, with applying a logical approach to success versus failure is a way to run your life, just like it is a way to apply science, right? So we keep on doing this thing over and over again, and it works, or we keep on doing this thing over and over again, and it doesn't work. It's like the definition of insanity, right? So how you do science, how we make decisions in a lab, is the same thing as how you make decisions on a day-to-day basis if you're trying to run your life in a logical manner. But that takes a conscious effort of being aware of what you're doing. And unfortunately, not everybody's equipped with that awareness, which, you know, is unfortunate.
Yeah, I was kind of just imagining like you in a lab and, you know, you're like, no, this data set says this. And then someone else is like, no. I see Snoopy in the clouds. It's this. So I don't know, just kind of, I was watching one of your videos recently and you kind of mentioned that, you know, sometimes with, a lab setting, you know, not everyone of course agrees. And then, you know, you have to basically take your different hypotheses and, figure out how to, I guess, dovetail those together.
Yeah, I mean, a good way of putting it is like's got nothing to do with it, right? You might like something. I might like a product. I might like an idea that I have. But if I try to replicate it 5, 10, 20 times and it doesn't do the thing that I wanted to do based off what I thought it was going to do because I liked it, then I have to question whether I should like it. And that should apply to your philosophy, how you run your life, or how you interact with a piece of gear or a tool. You know, it's all functionally related. It's all the same thing.
I know you've got a lot of different interests, and I noticed recently you started talking about music a lot more on your app Synthesis channel. Is that going to be kind of a theme going forward, or are you going to create a whole new channel for that and kind of try and keep everything parsed out?
Great question, actually. That's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, actually. What I'm probably going to do is, and, you know, unfortunately, going back to what I said, kind of the Maynard James Keenan example for the singer from Tool, where there's just not enough bands to satisfy all of his interests.
Right.
I actually have like probably like 5 or 6 YouTube channels. I only actively post mostly on the App Synthesis and the Basic American, formerly Post American Preparedness channel. But I have a couple other ones, and there's one that I actually recently created that I've planning on putting some blues music on and just having a basic blues music channel.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I'm actually going to put some effort into that. And what I'm going to do is once I accumulate a certain amount of material on there, I'm going to post a link on my App Synthesis community section where people can go check that out. I also have another one that I kind of post to sometimes, but I don't really want to put that public right now just because it's just kind of a doodle experimental channel. But to answer your question, what I'm probably going to get back to, and this will be a really good kind of, I guess, kind of final thought, because I'm going to probably have to wrap this up because I'm noticing we're getting kind of late here, is...
Yeah, we're coming up on about an hour and a half. So we did well.
That's pretty impressive. But no, on the App Synthesis channel, what I think I'm probably going to do is start going back to more of the videos that grew the channel into the 3,000 range, which is basically kind of like knife and like Swiss Army knife and just basic little gadgets and doodads for survival type of stuff and keep it light.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm going to do with basic American preparedness at this point. I'm not really feeling it right now, so I'm just not posting there. And then I have this this blues concept that I'm toying with, and I'm gonna build up some material there and just have it be just an artist channel. I'm probably not gonna like interact with subscribers or comments or anything, just post material. And that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Do you plan on, you know, branching out into any other social media, or are you gonna just stick with YouTube?
I'm probably going to stick with YouTube. I do have a personal Facebook for my family. And, you know, beyond, I do have a Instagram, but I'm probably going to stick with the YouTube just because I'm not a big fan of introducing more apps to my equipment. Like, for example, I don't do TikTok. I don't have TikTok downloaded on anything.
Yeah, so. I don't either. I looked at that one and I was like, no, I'll pass.
Right. Well, I mean, that's, you know, it's like there's kind of like the, covert ways that they're infiltrating our stuff. And then there's just like, okay, here, let's just download them infiltrating our stuff. So that's kind of the difference between YouTube and Facebook. And
yeah, TikTok. No, it makes sense. And also, I mean, time's finite. There's only so much time, you know, in your day or your week to really mess with social media, especially, you know, like, you know, a guy like yourself, you've got a lot going on and, you know, it's hard to kind of allocate time for, you know, another social media platform. So I totally get it.
100%.
Well, I guess I think this is probably a good point to wrap up this episode. I know you do have to get going. It is getting late there. And I'm really glad we got to cover several topics and, you know, perhaps we can, you know, do this again at some point. And, you know, I really do want to thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, 100%. I actually would like to do this again and, you know, learn more about you, actually.
Well, I've been working on kind of setting everything up for, you know, doing some lives and I think I've kind of got everything dialed in and, hopefully, maybe we can do a live sometime. That might be a lot of fun.
I would love to do a live and on camera. That would be amazing.
You got it. Yeah, I've been running everything through it's a OBS studio, and there's this thing called OBS Ninja, which is a basically you open it up in your browser, and you know you can send someone a link, and then basically that's how you can import their video into OBS. So we can definitely make that happen.
Let's do it, man.
All right, cool. Well, and I also want to, you know, thank you to anyone that's listening. And of course, if you're interested in checking out more content from either Basic American Preparedness or App Synthesis, then you can find both on YouTube by searching for at American Preparedness and at App Synthesis. So again, thank you very much. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, you too. Appreciate it, Ben. Have a great night.
There is a signal broadcast every second of every day through our television sets.
Mark my words, AI is far more dangerous than nukes.
Science and technology are propelling us forward at accelerating rates.
Engines throttling up, three engines now at 104%.